What in God's name do you need a solvent for except to kill someone?
That's an outrageous slur.
Google it, mate.
The only way that you can preserve peace is to prepare for war.
Views on News with Mark Latham. Mark Latham.
It's a Wednesday afternoon. We normally speak to Mark Latham on a Thursday afternoon, but he'll be on a plane this time tomorrow, so we swapped days. The leader of One Nation in New South Wales, Mark Latham, we welcome him to the program. Hi, Mark.
G'day, Brent. Always good to talk to you, no matter the day.
How are you?
Yeah, good. Good, thanks.
That's good. The biggest story of the week is the Kathleen Folbig story. She's been released from prison. She's been pardoned. She spent the last 20 years in prison for the death of her four children. It seems as though the conversation on many people's tips of their tongue is the talk of compensation, and will she or won't she get compensation? I believe she's already done a deal, like a big dollar deal, upwards of, you know, $500,000, and she'll be appearing on Sunday night on the Channel 7 Spotlight program. Your thoughts on this story, Mark?
Well, I'm sure she'll make a lot of money through the media, no doubt about that. There's been a lot of public interest in this particular story. But as for the pardon, I think the Attorney General, Michael Daly, got the cart before the horse in that everyone wanted to see the public release of the Tom Bathurst review into the Folbig case to see what was recommended and what the expert opinion was. So ahead of that, apparently after a briefing from Tom Bathurst, the former head of the Supreme Court in New South Wales, Michael Daly, the Attorney General, issued the pardon. One Nation spoke against the pardon in Parliament, mainly for the reason that while the scientific evidence about this genetic condition is being used to explain the death of the two Folbig daughters, there's still no valid explanation of the death of the two sons. And I think it's also influential, it certainly was in the original conviction, that the husband is the one who dobbed Kathleen Folbig in. He found the diary. The diary was, you know, quite incriminating about what had gone on, the allegation that she was a child killer, and she was convicted on that basis. So I think we needed more information before a pardon could be issued, and quite frankly, this was a big campaign by the feminist side of politics. I think if it was a man, he'd still be in jail.
And with the compensation side of things, I was reading a story today where they say that it will be a big ask for the compensation to be awarded, because at the time that she was convicted, the technology that has led to the pardon was not available at the time. And for that reason alone, there's a big question mark over financial compensation.
Yeah, you can't say it was a false conviction on the basis of technology that didn't exist. I mean, the courts have got to deal with the reality and the information they're presented with at a certain period in time. But you know, the Attorney General, Michael Daly, was out there basically inviting for her to sue the state of New South Wales for wrongful conviction, or spoke of an ex gratia payment, that is the government, you know, without even a legal compulsion, making a payment to Kathleen Folbig. So I'm sure she'll get money from the media, and looks like she'll get money from the New South Wales government, but I would have liked to have seen the full process unfold, the Bathurst report be open to publication and public scrutiny before any decision was made.
The payment you talk about, the possible payment you talk about from the New South Wales government, that decision, is that a parliamentary decision? In other words, does it go forward to Parliament and be voted upon?
No, it's a cabinet decision. Basically, Michael Daly would recommend an ex gratia payment, a special one-off payment to Kathleen Folbig in recognition of her circumstances. So he spoke about that in announcing the pardon. And I think that's where it's headed. It would be a cabinet decision to hand over taxpayers' money to Kathleen Folbig in these circumstances, and I think that's what Daly's got in the back of his mind.
The second story, again, we referred to the Spotlight program with the Kathleen Folbig story this Sunday night. Last Sunday night, the former coalition staffer Bruce Lerman appeared on that show and said it would appear that he was framed in relation to an allegation he raped his former colleague Brittany Higgins in Parliament House. Of course, as we know, he pleaded not guilty to raping Higgins during the trial. That was aborted. I don't think we'll ever get to the bottom of these stories, shall we, Mark?
Well, more information is coming out. I don't know where all these leaks are going to the Daily Mail, But there's text messages and even transcripts of conversations between Brittany Higgins, her boyfriend, Lisa Wilkinson. It appears that there was an attempt to use friendly MPs inside the then Labor opposition to ask questions about Brittany Higgins, not so much about the justice questions, but as a political hit job on the Morrison government. And I've got to, you have to say, looking back, it was very effective as a political hit job on the Morrison government. Scott Morrison didn't really know what to say about it. So more information is coming out, and we've always had a suspicion it was more than just a matter of a criminal allegation. It was also very much about politics leading into the last federal election. So I think that's where probably the story will head in the future. As for the substantive allegation, I'm in two minds about it. I think when it's he said, she said, there'll never be enough evidence to convict beyond reasonable doubt. But at the same time, I think in 99 times out of 100, if two young staffers who've been out socialising come back to Parliament House at 2 a.m. on a Saturday morning, it is about sex, not picking up research papers and so forth, the story that's been presented. So we'll never really know the truth. Only the two involved will know the truth, and they'd been out drinking. But it was certainly much more politics in the end than the pursuit of natural justice for Brittany Higgins.
Mark, what's your thoughts on the rumoured to be $3 million payment that Brittany Higgins was given by the government? The decision was made in almost, I think it was less than a day, and it was at an inquiry that the... I suppose she was awarded the money because of the conditions that she was working under, apparently. And the two people that she worked under, as in, I suppose, her two bosses, that being Linda Reynolds and Michaelia Cash, they weren't even allowed to appear at the inquiry. And they were told that if they were to appear at the inquiry, if they were to make an appearance, there would be no legal people supplied to these people. In other words, they'd have to pick up their own legal tab.
Well, the $3 million is a lot of compensation for work conditions, especially considering it wasn't compulsory. It was voluntary for Brittany Higgins to return to her workplace at 2 a.m. on a Saturday morning. So I wouldn't have made the payment, especially given the fact that criminality has never been proven. It's always going to be doubtful as to what really happened. So do you hand over $3 million worth of taxpayers' funds in those circumstances? I don't think so.
No, more to come about that, and I don't think there's been enough said about it. It just sort of was swept under the carpet, that $3 million payment. That's an enormous amount of money.
Well, some people are saying refer it to this new corruption commission
they've
got in Canberra, because if there was collusion between the Higgins camp and the Albanese opposition to use this as a political tactic, and it certainly damaged the Morrison government politically, then the $3 million payment in that context looks very suspect indeed.
It does. Take one for the team. Take one for the team. That's essentially the message that the Reserve Governor, Phil Lowe, has delivered to us as he's put up the interest rates. The RBA have put up the interest rates again. It's, what, the 12th increase of interest rates in 13 months, Mark? A lot of people are happy about this, and Jim Chalmers is dodging left, right and centre.
Well, Philip Lowe ought to take one for the team and resign, because he's very much responsible for getting the monetary policy wrong. I mean, at the end of 2021, if you didn't see inflationary pressures coming, you weren't looking. And he's only got one job, to look for inflationary pressures, because with the post-COVID problems with the supply chains and international inflation building, then clearly inflation was on the rise. And from Peter Costello down, a whole range of commentators were saying we needed an increase in interest rates at the end of 2021 to nip it in the bud, to nip inflation in the bud. But Philip Lowe delayed. He'd been telling people Australians could plan around 2 years of no further interest rate rises, and now we've had 12 in 13 months. So it's a classic example of this guy, the governor of the Reserve Bank, getting it all wrong. And now he's out there saying, oh, people can spend less and work longer hours. And he's given other advice to potential home buyers and the like that's fairly gratuitous advice. I mean, this guy, it's amazing he's still in his job. You'll never find someone in charge of the leading monetary policy authority getting it so wrong and somehow surviving in his own place of employment. He should have fallen on his sword, or Jim Chalmers should have got rid of him.
Why do you think that hasn't happened? Because, my goodness, there has been quite a few people asking for that to happen.
Well, the Reserve Bank notionally is independent, and government's not supposed to interfere. But independence can't mean you're allowed to make an absolutely ginormous mistake that's hurting millions of Australians and have no consequences for it. I mean, independence of the Reserve Bank goes to how they make their policies, but if the policies are all wrong and the individual making the decisions has got it all wrong and has not performed to a decent standard, the government's got the right to step in and say, well, look, we need competence in this role. You've got it hopelessly wrong. You failed to act when inflationary pressures were clear. You've had all these interest rate rises too many too late. You've got policy all wrong, and you must pay a price for that. So maybe Chalmers is weak, but plenty of people, quite rightly, are saying that if you've got an important policy wrong, like interest rate settings, over such a period of time, Philip Lowe should be out the door.
Look, he's the man at the top. He's the governor. I mean, he just comes across as being so out of touch with everyday Australians. Take one for the team. That was yesterday. And what was last time they put the interest rate up? It was, well, you know, why don't you take a boarder in, a lodger in? Do that. Take an extra lodger into your spare bedroom. I mean, this sort of stuff is just ridiculous to come from the governor of the Reserve Bank, Mark.
Yeah, it looks arrogant, it sounds out of touch, and from someone who really, you know, he wants to give some advice, it should have been his own advice at the end of 2021 to get in early with interest rate rises, to knock inflation right on the head so you didn't have to let it get out of control and do many more interest rate rises later on. So he seems to take no admission of his own failings, but they're obvious. They should be obvious to the Treasurer, Jim Chalmers. He ought to step in and say it's time for you to go, and we need a new Governor of the Reserve Bank who displays a much higher level, not only of competence, but also understanding of the damage that's being caused without all this arrogant advice.
The New South Wales government has been forced to drop a key part of its election promise to tackle rental affordability. This was a story in the Telegraph today. Experts have warned it would instead drive up prices and lock tenants into leases they could not afford. So this is a backflip, is it not?
Well, it's a broken promise. It's the first clear broken promise of the new Minns government. You know, they haven't got a lot of policies, Brent, but this is a policy they've now stepped away from, and it was always going to cause a problem. If you allow real estate agents to notify a potential tenant or someone else is bidding higher than you, then it opens up an auction that drives up the rental price. So it was always going to be counterproductive for renters to have this sort of auction war going to end the secret arrangements and have it all disclosed so they could outbid each other and the rents would go sky high. So it was always a bad policy. It was had no support in the New South Wales Parliament. We were opposing it, the Greens were opposing it, everyone on the crossbench was opposing it, so it wasn't going to go through, and Minns has had to break the promise with this particular policy. And as I mentioned, he hasn't got many policies. I think for every one policy they've got out there, the new Labor government, there's about 10 policy reviews, you know, putting it out to other people to sort out what needs to be done. So it's not a very good sign of where the government's headed, and not a very good sign for policy making in general.
Mark, there was an art display in New South Wales Parliament House. It's what's it all about, this woke art display? I see there's a story around today where you've been accused of pinching a skin of a possum or something like that. I mean, for God's sake, haven't they got more important things to worry about?
Well, Brent, you just would not believe how wacky some of the things are that they bring in a New South Wales Parliament House, put them on display and call them art. This thing is a collection of junk, and it looks more like a lost and found depot than a proper art exhibition. Now, there's a fountain court on the main level of New South Wales Parliament with some display walls. It should be reserved for the best of student art, particularly from the HSC in New South Wales, or artworks from the regions that come to the city to encourage regional artists in their work. But the thing they've got in there at the moment, it sort of defies description. There's sort of little kids' storybooks on podiums. One of them's about how kids should enjoy farts. I kid you not. There's another item there about how we should all wear solar panel sunglasses. There's a display of political statements, including in 10 years' time, all politicians in Australia will apologise to Julia Gillard for misogyny. And in 100 years' time, Australia won't have the currency we've got today. The currency will be solar power. I don't know what that means. We all go live in North Queensland to get more sunshine. So, I mean, this stuff is as weird and wacky and, quite frankly, as embarrassing as you'll ever see. And it sort of just sits there disjointed and unprofessional. Apparently it's funded by government art subsidies for people to do this work. But don't worry about taking a few items and showing it to my colleagues just how bad it is. The whole thing should be thrown in the bin. And the space that we've got there in Parliament House should be reserved for our school students and their artwork, particularly in Year 12, instead of just displaying woke political garbage that, quite frankly, your average person in New South Wales would be horrified if they saw it and knew that it was being displayed at taxpayers' expense.
Yeah. We were talking earlier about, you know, RBA governors being out of touch. It seems as though the people that organise these things are out of touch as well.
Well, it's supposed to be some museum of the future. I mean, if they know the future, it shouldn't be in a museum. They should, if they know the future, these people, they should be at the racetrack getting a few winners. But I don't know what a museum of the future is. It just looks like it's an excuse for random nonsense to be displayed. Maybe the people running the collection know certain authors of kids' books, but they're displayed. There's a statement there of Darth Vader, made out of coal, that coal is, you know, the dark side, evil. Very disrespectful to anyone who works in the coal industry, and there's tens of thousands of people doing that in New South Wales. So there's all these political statements, but not even done cleverly or professionally. All the stuff on the wall, including the Gillard and the solar currency statements, there's about 30 or 40 of those, all wacky and weird. Why can't we just have normal art promoting the best of our young people in New South Wales, the best of our regional artists, and leave the politics for the two parliamentary chambers? We've got enough Greens and left-wing extremists in the Parliament, upper and lower house, to deal with all that. Why do we need to have it taxpayer-funded in the display area as well?
Aaron sent in an email and said, if you get time, can you ask Marth Latham this question? He said, it's about the two blokes that were given clemency in Vietnam with the help of the Prime Minister. They were facing the death penalty. Their names haven't been released, nor have the crimes that they were found guilty of. Aaron says, why so much secrecy then?
Well, there shouldn't be secrecy, really. This has happened under the urgings of the Australian Prime Minister, so haven't the Australian people got the right to know their names and the crimes and the details of the clemency that's been issued? I don't know why it would be secret. I've never known of any of these things to be secret in the past. So I suppose you'd have to get an answer from Albanese's office.
As to why there's so much secrecy, another question for Mark. What's the difference between The Voice and the NIAA, Mark?
Got no idea. Is this a punchline?
No. What's the difference between the Voice to Parliament and the NIAA that we already have set up?
Oh, well, what does that stand for, the NIAA? What is that? That's the National Indigenous Authority or something.
Yeah, National Indigenous Authority.
Well, that's the point I've spoken of previously. We've got 85 taxpayer-funded Indigenous consultative groups and authorities in Australia. The Voice will be the 86th. Why do we need it? I mean, these outfits are everywhere. At federal and state level, in New South Wales, for instance, there's a group called the Indigenous Education Consultative Group that run 20 schools, publicly funded schools in New South Wales, now under Indigenous leadership and direction. Mm-hmm. So there's no shortage of Indigenous input in the example I just gave, schools like Walgett and Bourke. They've been running those, I've got to say, with no great success. So, yeah, I don't see how The Voice is needed, because a variation of The Voice has been tried and failed many times right around the country.
Thank you for spending some time with us this afternoon. As always, have a safe trip tomorrow, and we'll catch up with you next week.
A pleasure. Thanks, Brent.
Thanks, Mark.